Good afternoon, and welcome to Bingham Presents 2010, broadcast live from Bingham McCutcheon LLP's offices in New York, and online at www.sechistorical.org, the virtual museum and archive of the history of financial regulation. My name is Eric Seary. I'm a professor of finance at Babson College in Massachusetts. From 2006 to 2009, I served as the director of the Division of Market Regulation, later the Division of Trading and Markets, at the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. The Bingham Presents series was debuted in 2009 and is made possible through a partnership between Bingham McCutcheon LLP and the SEC Historical Society. Bingham McCutcheon offers market-leading practices focused on the financial services industry, encompassing everything from bank, securities, and investment law and regulation to financing, structured transactions, and restructuring. Its 1,100 lawyers serve in 12 locations, including financial and regulatory centers such as New York, Washington, London, and Tokyo. The SEC Historical Society shares, preserves, and advances knowledge of the history of financial regulation through its unique virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. The museum is free and accessible worldwide at all times and currently welcomes more than 22,000 visitors a month. I serve on the museum committee, advising on the growth and outreach of the museum. Both the Society and the Museum are independent of and separate from the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and receive no funding from the public sector. The Society is grateful for the support and assistance of Bingham McCutcheon in making this program possible. Last year's Bingham Presents looked at the new world of financial regulation and the global financial crisis of 2008. A year later, that new world is becoming a reality with the passage of the Dodd-Frank Act. Tonight, we will look at one aspect of the changing world, the harmonization of the regulation of investment advisors and broker-dealers. I'm delighted to welcome my distinguished fellow presenters who will join me in this discussion. These are people I've known for years and have had the pleasure of working with when I was at the commission. On my immediate left is Hardy Calcott, a partner at Bingham McCutcheon and a member of the Society's Board of Advisors. On his left is Michael Sharp, the general counsel for Jefferies and Company. And on Michael's right is David Titsworth, Executive Director and Executive Vice President of the Investment Advisor Association. Our discussion today will look at such issues as the standard of care, fiduciary duty or suitability, and is there a difference? Are the disclosure obligations for broker-dealers and investment advisors appropriate? Ultimate regulator and examiner for broker-dealers and advisors, the role of state supervision versus SEC oversight, and is there a role for FINRA? Regulation beyond the standard of care, is there a level playing field? Before we begin our program, I'd like to state that the views of the presenters are their own and do not reflect those of Bingham McCutcheon or the SEC Historical Society. The Society is responsible for the selection of the moderator and presenters. We presenters have determined the questions that will guide the content of our discussion. So let me start us off and talk about where we find ourselves right now. The FPA decision dealt the SEC a bit of a setback a while ago with regard to its approach to fee-based brokerage accounts that provided a certain amount of advice. And so the SEC regrouped. And as part of its process of regrouping, it commissioned the RAND Corporation to do a report, which became known as the RAND Report. Out of that voluminous report came a number of findings. Let me tell you about what I think are the most salient ones very briefly. First, investors had a difficult time in distinguishing among who was an investment advisor and who was a broker-dealer, especially in light of the, quote, we do it all positioning of the providers. Second, investors liked certain trait of investment advisors. They liked the disclosure requirements, the legal duties, and the compensation structure. On the other hand, investors also liked traits of the broker-dealer model. They liked the account minimums, they liked the industry certifications, as well as the low costs of the model. Investors generally tended to be happy with their financial service providers, and they seemed to value the personal service and the attentiveness over the expertise and performance that was conferred on their accounts. Investors acknowledge that they do not really understand the fees they pay for investments and for services, And what I think is perhaps most interesting, which I think many of us knew, financial service participants also acknowledge that investors don't read the disclosures, even if they're well written, which I think is something to keep in mind as we go forward here. So let me start us off. I'm going to start by turning first to Hardy and to ask him to perhaps open by discussing what he sees as the benefits as well as the shortcomings of the broker-dealer regime for investor accounts.
So the regulatory scheme for broker-dealers is a very extensive, very rule-based regulatory regime. There are, there's a big FINRA manual that includes NASD, FINRA, and NYSE rules. There's a big SEC set of rules. It is very detailed and precise, and there are a lot of cops on the beat policing that the brokerage model. Broker-dealers are subject to examinations by the SEC, by every SRO that they're a member of, and if you do business with members of the public, then you're required to be a member of FINRA, and they're subject to examination by the states in which they do business. So there's sort of three levels of cops policing this very detailed set of rules, and so broker-dealers have pretty explicit guidance about what they're supposed to do in different kinds of circumstances. As I said, there are a lot of people enforcing those rules.
What about the shortcomings of the broker-dealer model? If you were to list them, how would you think about them?
Well, I would say the shortcoming of both the broker-dealer and the investment advisor model, to be frank, is there is too much noncompliance with the rules. I mean, every SEC commissioner, when you ask them, what was the most surprising thing that you learned when you came to the commission, it is that there are so many cases. There are so many violations, and many of the violations are not technical violations, but, straight out-and-out fraud violations. And, there are several hundred a year by the SEC against the advisor industry and the broker-dealer industry, which doesn't even count the more than 1,000 cases a year that FINRA brings against the broker-dealer industry. So that, to me, is the biggest shortcoming, is that there is, even after all the resources the industry has put to compliance and supervision, there's not the end result that you would hope to see.
David, can I ask you the same question with regard to investment advisors?
Absolutely. I'm not sure I heard any weakness there of the broker-dealer regime, but I'll start with what I think, Eric, is the weakness for the investment advisor profession, and that's the SEC, right now at least, does not have enough resources police a growing industry. We've put out a report for the last 10 years, ever since investment advisors have had to file Form ADV Part 1 electronically, and what it shows is a steady growth of advisors from about 7,000 in 2001 to more than 11,000 today. The SEC resources, at least post Sarbanes-Oxley, have stayed relatively constant. You have about 450 examiners to oversee 11,000 advisors, 9,000 investment companies. That's not enough. Dodd-Frank will change that, by the way. You're going to more than double the SEC resources, going from $1.1 billion to $2.25 billion by 2015. They're going to reduce the number of advisors significantly, and maybe we'll talk about this when we get to state regulation, but you get rid of or shift 4,000 or so investment advisors from SEC to state regulation. So I think that the SEC is well on its way to having more resources to deal with this growing population. But going to the strengths of investment advisor regulation, it is less rules-based, certainly much more of a principles-based scheme. I think that that's appropriate for the profession. You have broad anti-fraud authority vested with the SEC. You have an overarching fiduciary duty that I have a feeling we'll probably be talking about somewhat today. But I also would point out that there's lots of rules. from insider trading to proxy voting to codes of ethics to advertising to custody to record keeping, form ADV, pay to play. The list is growing larger every day, and it's sure as hell not going to get any shorter after Dodd-Frank. And on top of that, you have what's known as the compliance program rule that the SEC adopted in 2004 that fills in all the spaces and says every investment advisor will have policies and procedures based on their characteristics to prevent violations of the securities law. So I think given the diversity of the investment advisor profession and its historical evolution, that this principles-based scheme is very appropriate.
I wonder if you could each spend a little bit of time talking about, and neither of you actually contrasted what is often brought up in this space, the question of suitability versus fiduciary duty, understanding that that can be a bit of a false comparison. I wonder if you could each in turn, however you want to do it, highlight how you think about the aptness of that comparison, and maybe you don't think it is apt at all.
Well, let me start with what I think is the broker-dealer perspective. So I think most of the broker-dealer industry has stated through their trade associations and individually that they're not opposed to having a fiduciary duty standard. I think what many people in the brokerage industry have concluded over the last 10 years, the majority of disputes with customers get resolved in an arbitration forum, now at FINRA, and in front of non-lawyer arbitrators who don't really understand the legal difference between suitability and fiduciary duty, and the result is brokers, I think, generally think that they're held to something that is very close to a fiduciary duty already. So I think certainly you can point to legal cases where a court found a violation of fiduciary duty where it wouldn't have found a violation of the suitability duty. I think the practical reality for most people in the brokerage industry has been that there hasn't been that much of a difference. That being said, the primary comment from the broker-dealer industry, again, coming from this very rules-based environment, the primary comment to the SEC on its study about this issue has been, give us as much specific guidance as you can about as many different circumstances as you can, and we'll comply with that guidance.
So before I turn it to David, let me ask you about that. Isn't that kind of counter to the approach one would take to a fiduciary duty, specific guidance about what is and what isn't? Doesn't that run counter to the approach, really, of how you think about fiduciary duty, as David said, principles-based?
I'm happy to handle that one.
Sure.
Yeah, that's a softball. There is a difference, clearly, between suitability and fiduciary duty. It isn't that one is bad and one is good. And by the way, Hardy, absolutely, I guess the way I look at this debate, I mean, there's been a lot of rhetoric on both sides that I think is unfortunately fortunate. Both investment advisors and broker-dealers are comprehensively regulated. And all you have to do is go out, as I do, and talk to broker-dealers. I was at a conference at Pershing yesterday, or investment advisors who are members of our organization, and talk to their compliance people. There are a lot of headaches on both sides. So I think, you know, there is this sort of underlying thing of, well, as investment advisors, or regulation bad or just not, it's weak, and I think that's nonsense, and I think it'd be nonsense to say that broker-dealer regulation is weak or non-existent. They're both comprehensive schemes. If there wasn't a difference between suitability and fiduciary duty, I'm not sure we'd all be sitting here today. The brokerage industry and probably even more, I've certainly saw it on Capitol Hill the last 2 years, where I've unfortunately had to spend a lot of my time. The insurance industry is absolutely adamant in saying fiduciary duty is something we don't want to have imposed on that. Why? All you attorneys out there, it's because of potential liability. It's because they're scared that they're going to be limited on the brokerage side by the principal trading restrictions under the Advisors Act, and they don't want to make the disclosures that advisors are required to make that is part of what makes fiduciary duty different from suitability. That's one of the aspects. But simply stated, fiduciary duty is on the advisor's side. It's been settled by law since 1963 when the United States Supreme Court ruled that there is a fiduciary duty under the Advisors Act. The words never appear in the statute, but they said under Section 206, the anti-fraud provision, it is part of the Advisors Act. It is the duty to at all times put the interests of your clients ahead of your own. This idea that it's so squishy that nobody understands it, I believe, is also erroneous and false. I testified a year ago, had the pleasure of sitting before the House Financial Services Committee, and at my table were the head of the state securities regulators, the head of FINRA, a consumer advocate, a representative from SIFMA, brokers, and an insurance industry representative myself. And this Republican, the ranking Republican, Spencer Backus, asked, listen, I've heard all these arguments about suitability, fiduciary duty. I want to know, is there a difference, and is fiduciary duty a higher standard? And without exception, every person at that table said, yes, fiduciary duty is a higher standard. There is a difference.
Mike, you, in your the various things that you've done over time, you've had boots on the ground in various capacities, both where you are now at Jefferies and in the past in some of your other positions. How do you think about these issues?
When I think about, first of all, just to get to the earlier point, with respect to the shortcomings on both the investment advisor side and the broker-dealer side, saying that the shortcoming is that people violate the law is like saying that the shortcoming with red lights is that people drive through them. I mean, red lights, if people adhere to them, stop cars. The laws that people adhere to them make people act properly, both on the advisory side and on the broker-dealer side. I think there is the difference between investment advisory and the practical difference between investment advisory and broker-dealer is how the street reacts to it. And for those of you who are on this side of the business, and for those of you who regulate this side of the business, you know that what you see is that the smarter, more sophisticated FAs are the ones who do investment advisory work. And those who can't pass certain standards on the broker-dealer side are not allowed to do investment advisory work. And so there is certainly a difference between suitability and investment advisory. There is a higher standard. I couldn't tell you. I'm not smart enough to define what that standard is. What it comes down to in practice is that you push the people who can't meet the advisory standard onto the broker-dealer side, and you also put a lot more, there are a lot more safety nets on the investment advisory side, with performance being a key indicator of what's going on, which you don't have on the suitability side. People look at performance. You're not going to get people changing habits, changing practices, usually on the broker-dealer side, based on performance.
So you said something I hadn't heard before, the point that there's almost a kind of sorting that goes on within a large firm, that is that if people sort of haven't been thinking properly about the issues, or they're not really up to snuff on some of their requirements, they're less likely to become, as an individual person, an advisor. They're more likely to carry the broker hat.
Yes.
That's interesting. That's not something I'd heard before. One of the things that's true in Dodd-Frank, as many of you probably know, is that there's a requirement that the SEC do a study about the harmonization of the advisor and the broker-dealer standard, and to look for some kind of a uniform standard of care. That's Section 913. I wonder if folks could discuss for me what they think about the way Dodd-Frank describes, about the points that are listed that Dodd-Frank describes that study should entail, and about what the most important questions are that the SEC should both ask and answer when they do this study, given that the RAND study's already come and gone. This is really a very different study, isn't it?
It's certainly a comprehensive or an extensive set of questions. I think there are 14. I've got the statute right here. We filed, Eric, a very extensive comment letter on August 30th. ruined summer vacation for some of my good attorneys. And a lot of other people filed comment letters as well. I think the SEC or Congress is asking SEC to look at a lot of the important questions. For a six-month study, they may have asked the SEC to answer more questions than is reasonable under the circumstances. But we know that our friends at the SEC have been looking at this issue. There's a task force from Chairman Shapiro's office and divisions of investment management and trading and markets and OC and general counsel's office and other divisions as well. We had a meeting with them last week. The insurance people were walking out as we were walking in. So I think they're asking the right questions, and the questions they're asking have to do with what do investors think? Are they confused about the standards that are out there and the activities of broker-dealers and investment advisors? Clearly, the answer to that is yes. But then they're also asking about, are there gaps or shortcomings or overlaps between the broker-dealer and the investment advisor regime? And that's where you can get into a lot of discussions well beyond fiduciary duty, which has kind of been the highly visible issue out there. But it'll be very interesting. And then you look at the statute, you know, what you had was actually the House, when it passed a bill, it required the SEC to do a rulemaking on various aspects of harmonization, but it highlighted fiduciary duty in the context of personalized investment advice to retail customers. But then the Senate punted and had a study, and what you see is Congress often does, it just kind of mashed them two together, the two approaches together in conference, and you end up with this. They went from a one-year study to a six-month study. They don't require a rulemaking. They authorize a rulemaking. There are bells and whistles beyond the personalized investment advice to retail customers, and commissions aren't a per se violation of fiduciary duty, et cetera, et cetera. Be very interesting. I certainly don't envy the task of the SEC in trying to sort all that out as it moves forward to a rulemaking, and it probably will result in a rulemaking. I think Hardy and I agree on that.
Yeah, I think some of the issues that the SEC is directed to look at and should look at, we've talked about, you know, differences in enforcement and examination resources, differences in the substantive regulatory schemes between advisors and broker-dealers. The issue that I think is very important that is in the statute and the SEC does need to look at is the issue of cost and availability of investment advice to individual investors. One of the findings from the RAND report that I thought was a little surprising, and I think the SEC was a little surprised, was a very large number of the individuals who RAND surveyed, the investors surveyed, said either they themselves or people they knew or family members had trouble getting investment advice at all. And I think either from the brokerage side or from the investment advisory side. And I think historically the investment advisory side has had, you know, higher sort of minimum net worth requirements. The question is for, you know, the sort of, you know, beginning investor or the, you know, middle class investor who doesn't have a substantial net worth, what can the SEC do to make quality investment advice available to more people? And there's a tension. You know, the cost of regulation, to some extent, has caused some firms to get out of the business of providing individualized financial advice because of the liability issues. And so the question the SEC has to face is, how can they raise the standard? And I think at a legal level, I'd answer the question yes as well. Fiduciary duty is a higher legal standard than suitability. How can you do that without causing even more ordinary Americans to be pushed out of getting investment advice at all?
You know, what speaking, you know, getting more granular about terms in the study, the statute defines what it means to be a retail investor, and it also talks about a term, personalized investment advice. I think this is somewhat of a key phrase, because all this question about duty and a uniform standard of care relates to the receipt or the delivery of personalized investment advice. How should we think about what that means within this context? Should we be picking up things that are essentially advice if they're prepackaged, such as in the form of tools? Is it clear that if it's a tool that can't possibly be personalized, is that just the way it is, or is that somewhat ambiguous? And how should we think about what it means to have personalized investment advice? You have plan, you have a full-blown financial plan on one side, maybe on the other extreme you've got market color. How should this be divvied up?
Well, I think there isn't a definition, so the SEC's kind of on its own, right? But I think when you look at it, it's advice that is tailored to an individual. So you've got a lot of questions, Eric, but I would say, you know, if I'm a broker-dealer, I'm just putting research out there that is nonspecific about, you know, emerging markets or fixed income or whatever the heck it might be. To me, that's not personalized investment advice. If you come to me with $50,000 and say, what should I do, and I make a specific recommendation of a security, that's clearly personalized investment advice. There are gradations in between.
So to push you, if I'm the advisor/broker and I say 60-40 stocks and bonds, that's personalized investment advice?
I think asset allocation absolutely is investment advice. I believe the SEC's been consistent about that for a long time. That's not quite as specific as saying, I want you to buy, you know, 500,000 shares of Siri International.
Don't do it.
I think there are a couple of issues that I agree with David. I think the sort of generalized research reports are not personalized investment advice. I would argue that sort of investment tools where an investor can go online and run kind of different scenarios where it's the investor who's making those choices, not, you know, the financial advisor, that's not personalized advice. I think the question that came up a lot in the comments to the SEC is, can you give personalized investment advice and then step back and be a broker again? So somebody can, you have someone come in and get a one-time sort of snapshot financial plan without thereby having an ongoing duty to monitor what that customer does in their account. Are they doing what you advise them to do? If they're doing unsolicited trades that are contrary to what you'd advise them, do you have a duty to step in and say, wait a minute, I didn't advise you to do that? I think it's that sort of ongoing obligation after the financial advice is provided that is the area where there's the greatest level of ambiguity and where the SEC would do well to provide some more clarity.
Yeah, I have a slightly different view on this. And in my mind, personalized investment advice is the sort of opposite way of saying advice incidental to providing broker-dealer services. It's not any different. And when, you know, you talked about the RAND study, these same, I bet if you were to go back and look at the proposing release talking about the RAND study, you could probably do a compare right, and many of these same questions were being asked back then. And in my mind, the study is a way of punting 6 months down the road some hard questions that people were not willing to answer right now. You know, I think it's very easy to define what personalized investment advice is. And because the street has been doing it for decades, the SEC has been doing it for decades, it may not have been memorialized in a certain way until now. It may get more memorialized, it may get more codified, but I think that when it comes down to it, it is a relatively easy thing to do. And I think, you know, to some degree, the fact that there is underlying all of this, I think there is more than there should be, perhaps, investor confusion that can be cleared up some with disclosure, with other means. But I think the biggest issue, to be frank, is that the street has strenuously avoided taking on fiduciary responsibility for silly reasons, in my mind. And
the street has already dealt with these issues. It's dealt with it sloppily. It's dealt with it by, on one level, every firm, all of the big wirehouses will publicly say that investors need a choice and things need to be done so that investors have choice, and I buy that completely. I said that myself. But what those firms don't do enough of, although they do it internally, they will push their people to become investment advisors because it's better business, it's smarter business, but they don't. There's a disconnect between what they push their people to do internally because it's good business and the public positions they take, which causes all of these questions to be raised that when it comes down to it have been asked and answered. And this study will show nothing more, I think, than the RAND study came out with. But I do think that you have to have the study because Congress said you have to do it. But I think at the end of the day, you will come to a model that is not much different from where we are right now, because you could drive a truck around what personalized investment advice means in the same way that you can drive a truck through what incidental advice means right now.
Could I just jump in and maybe get a little more granular here and I guess first start with a more generalized point? We have our organization, the Investment Advisory Association, has said that brokers who are doing the same thing as investment advisors should be treated the same way under the law. I think, in general, most of us could hold hands and agree that people that are doing the same thing should have the same legal obligations. So we're not saying, by the way, that a broker should be a fiduciary in all situations. It's only when they're providing investment advice. Brokers do a lot of things other than provide investment advice. A broker is a person who is effecting securities transactions, the last time I read the 1934 Act.
Let me interrupt. I know you have a point, but I want to ask you something because I thought of it as you made your previous point. The way you said it, could a broker ever make a solicit a trade and have that not be advice? The way you're formulating advice?
I think that is the million-dollar question, right? So I'm going to answer it by giving a longer answer. I think we would...
As long as you answer.
I'll be curious. I mean, I want to see if Hardy agrees with these. But I think there's a continuum, right? Discretionary advice, I think everybody would agree... If anyone gives discretion to an advisor, a person, call themselves a financial advisor, a broker-dealer, whatever, I think that is fiduciary duty standard.
Anyone want, well, let's stop. Anyone want to sort of, and you all want to caveat that or anything?
No.
Okay, so you got one.
Okay, hooray. And actually, I'm looking at Schwab's comment letter on this Section 913 study, and I guess they start out at the high-end comprehensive wealth management, including discretion to trade, as well as comprehensive planning advice across a range of non-investment financial matters. Another one, discretionary investment portfolio or account management. Two, non-discretionary investment advisor program for a fee. I think that we would all agree that that is subject to the fiduciary duty under the Advisors Act.
With the caveat that fiduciary duty itself is a sliding scale, and you have, I would argue, higher duties to a discretionary account than you do to a non-discretionary account.
Well, maybe we can agree, or I'll try to get closer agreement thereby, but I'll give you my hypothesis, which is that, I mean, I think the fiduciary duty under the Advisors Act is the fiduciary duty under the Advisors Act, 1963, five decades worth of jurisprudence, actually several decades before that, both the SEC courts interpreting this federal fiduciary standard. So that's out there. But I think that just because someone has fiduciary duty doesn't mean that you accept ongoing portfolio management responsibilities. Even if you're a fiduciary, you come to me and say, here's my money. what should I do with it? And I say, look, I'm willing to give you some advice right now, but I'm not going to monitor this account on an ongoing basis. I think I can do that as a fiduciary, but I'm telling you up front. So to me, it's more like saying, you and I, the client and the advisor, the person giving advice, can have that scope of fiduciary duty. And if that's the sliding scale you're referring to, Hardy, I think we're more in agreement than not.
No. Well, I actually disagree with that point. I think there is not a sliding scale.
We were close.
I think there is not a sliding scale. I think if you have a discretionary account, that is fully discretionary, and the client doesn't make the decision, that's fiduciary. I think if you have a non-discretionary advisory account that has equal fiduciary responsibility, and when you see that client not taking your advice, when you see that client moving away from what you're advising him to do, as a fiduciary, you have to fire the client. You have to stop getting paid for giving advice, because at that point, you are no longer, you basically, that client is rejecting your advice, and as a fiduciary, doing that which is in the best interest of your client, you can't get paid.
You know, I just want to echo what you said, Mike. You know, when we were working on this at the commission, a number of people from large firms came in and made that point about when you fire your client. And I think it's really to protect, the firms pointed out this was to protect themselves.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so I'll see your 1963 and raise you to 1943, SEC v. Chenery Corp. Fiduciary duty isn't the end of the analysis, it's the beginning of the analysis. You know, the question is, what is the scope of the fiduciary duty? What is the nature of the breach? What is the remedy for the breach? I guess my point would be, fiduciary duty isn't really a uniform standard. A fiduciary duty in, for example, a trust context where you've got duties to beneficiaries that may not even have been born yet is completely different from a fiduciary duty in a non-discretionary advisory account, where I agree with you, it is, in my view, fully permissible to say, I'm going to give you advice today, and then 6 months later, we're going to sit down again, and I'm not going to talk to you in the intervening 6 months. Again, that's a perfectly, and the law of agency allows you to negotiate the scope of fiduciary duty. But fiduciary duty, you know, has become, you know, sort of a slogan, when in fact it is, in my view, a much more complicated concept than a slogan really allows for.
I'm going to, you know, interject with something. There was a letter that was written by our current chair of the SEC, Mary Shapiro, to the commission. This is when she was at FINRA. And she describes fiduciary duty, and this was in responding to FPA, so I don't mean to take this out of context. I'm going to read a very short portion. And those of you who are interested should go back and read the entire letter. But points out that within, in a list, pointing out her views about how accurately FPA characterized FINRA's position, pointed out that, quote, the contours of an advisor's fiduciary duty are imprecise and indeterminate. Indeed, these contours have developed unevenly over time, and much of what the FPA describes as an advisor's fiduciary duty is more implied than expressed. Point is that even today, you know, our current head of the SEC, having run a broker-dealer SRO, clearly has a view there, and I think it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I'm not trying to, you know, rope someone in on their past comments. She had a job to do in the past. I don't know, you know, how you look at that comment.
I believe that letter was April 2005, signed by Mary Shapiro.
It is indeed.
Walter, and it was filed to the SEC in this broker-dealer exclusion context that the FPA decision unfortunately invalidated. So I've certainly wondered about that as well, Eric, and I hope that all the commissioners keep an open mind. I would disagree with the notion, as I read that letter, and you read just one sentence from it,
absolutely.
But to me, it basically says the broker-dealer regime is better than the investment advisor regime. And going back, I guess that's where I take issue. I think brokers are comprehensively regulated. I think advisors are comprehensively regulated. There are differences. Some of them are historical. Some of it's because it's appropriate to each industry. Are either one of them perfect? Probably not. Can we improve them? Absolutely. But I think this, you know, it's counterproductive to start this discussion of, like, one is better than the other.
And
that's what, to me, what that letter says, and that's too bad.
I think that's a key point. that it's this is people want to that that is what generates this argument, is that is investment advisory better than broker dealer? It's different, and it's more expensive, and there and you get more for your money. But if you don't want that, then you go into a broker dealer model. It's that simple.
You know, it's Hardy. I think mentioned this one, at one point a little earlier. He talked about costs, and as I read sort of 913 of Dodd-Frank, it clearly contemplates and asks questions about the costs, and that goes hand in hand with the other thing it mentions, which is choice. I think the statute clearly is concerned that if you don't get this right, choice can be curtailed. And what I think the way to look at it is they're thinking, look, the broker-dealer model does appear to be cheaper than the advisor model for any number of reasons. I think we've been talking about them. And if you just elevate the standard, you run a risk of cutting off a basket of services that is clearly valued by a segment of society. On the other hand, within that basket, you may be essentially delivering some modicum of advice that you would call advice, and you've got to make a trade-off. Do you want to cut off that valuable portfolio of services, which are low cost and efficient, but some amount of advice may go with it? That seems to me essential in trying to figure out. You've got to figure out where you want to come out in there. And I think one piece of this, and Mike, maybe you could talk about it, is the principal transaction question.
Mm-hmm.
Given your experience, I mean, how do you want to, you know, 2063 is not talked about in this portion of the of Dodd-Frank. How do you think about the principal transaction issue?
Well, it's not talked about, but they do expressly state that you wouldn't be violating their proposal by having the ability to sell principal products, and they don't use 2063. I think that, you know, after the FBA decision and the whole the change in the law to what is now the non-discretionary advisory model, the question was answered that you really can't do this without allowing principal trades. And what you have in place right now is a regime that is unworkable. You know, you have a carve-out for the non-discretionary advisory model where you don't have to get trade-by-trade written consent. But unless you can allow...
Although that goes away at the end of this year, and the SEC said they're not going to renew it.
Yeah, well, that's fine. And if they don't renew it, what will happen, you know what's happening right now, is that the street is mobilizing. You can't have an advisory program, certainly a non-discretionary advisory program, without principal trading, and I think you cannot have an effective discretionary advisory model without principal trading. What you need to be careful about is double charging people, overcharging people. I mean, if you have a discretionary advisory model, you can't buy IPOs. You buy them, but then they sit in a separate broker dealer account for some number of months before they go in, so you don't charge people too much. You miss very useful structured products. There are many, many things that having that ban will make it unworkable to have both principal trading and if you don't allow principal trading, you will not have the ability to give sound investment advice.
And I guess the other area that people regularly point to is fixed income. So bonds, municipal bonds, and to a lesser extent, corporate bonds. You know, for retail investors who are buying and selling small lots, you don't get good prices if you have to do agency trading away from your firm. And so if the result of adoption of a fiduciary duty standard is worse executions for retail customers on fixed income, you know, that's a bad result, and the SEC should try to avoid that.
It's funny. I met an investment advisor who used to work for a brokerage firm yesterday, as a matter of fact, and she was saying she got tired of selling fixed income products that were marked up by her brokerage firm. So I think it goes both ways. Look, to me, the 2063 in the Advisors Act restricts principal trading. You have to get consent of the client on a transaction-by-transaction basis. A lot of people tell me that is effectively a ban on principal transactions. It's very difficult to get that. But what I don't understand is the SEC has broad exemptive authority under 206. So if all these wonderful things that are talked about, principal trading involves an inherent conflict of interest. You're selling or buying something for your customer from your own account. That is an inherent conflict of interest. Now, maybe there are all sorts of reasons why those conflicts can be mitigated or disclosed, but so why doesn't anybody go in and ask for exemptive relief from the SEC?
They have. And it's been turned down uniformly.
Well, although I will say a lot of firms relied on the temporary rule 206.3-3, which is going to expire, and the SEC Division of Trading and Markets has suggested, okay, firms come in and get individual exemptive relief now will be open to that. But I think there are, you know, clearly situations. You know, I'm from California. We have very high state taxes, so California state bonds are very desirable investments. And, you know, for the firm to be able to go out and buy some of those and have them in inventory for when customers want them, that's a benefit to customers. And as I say, when the customer wants to sell and you're selling 5 bonds or 10 bonds, if you have to go out and bid that to the street as opposed to have the firm be able to buy it into inventory, you're just not going to get a good price. And as I say, if the result of fiduciary duty is worse executions for customers, that's a bad result.
I guess we have to remember why we're doing this. This is all about, at some level, investor protection and investor welfare. And if you're costing them more money on the execution side, then, you know, don't forget, 206.3, I think, was not so much about executions as it was the basic, what I might call the research conflict, the idea that the quality of the paper going in the portfolio was somehow known not to be, you know, beneficial. You still have, the broker still has a best execution obligation. So not since you've got the execution side covered. If we do this, if we go down this path where 206.3 remains, so the advisor still has the prohibition, yet under this enhanced broker-dealer story, the broker-dealer can perhaps, with, you know, upfront disclosure, consummate the principal trade. Now we're left with that distinction. I mean, if you're comfortable with that, then somehow you believe that upfront disclosure with regard to the principal conflict gets you off the hook with the broker-dealer. So why are you leaving it with the advisor who may have a non-discretionary account? What would the logic be? Haven't we just kicked that can down the road and now just left the principal trading problem?
Yes. Absolutely. But that's why I don't think it's workable. It makes no sense today, and it certainly makes no sense having a bifurcated world.
Let me turn to something else that is in the air and not often associated, perhaps, with the IABD question, but I think is interesting. Most of you probably know that the SEC, Buddy Donahue with the SEC, the commission, properly, has proposed revisions to Rule 12b-1 and does many, many things. But amongst the things it does is it caps 12b-1 payments. And, you know, one of the things, a number of people who had come into the commission had pointed that in the debate between business models, IA versus a BD, one of the great things about the BD model was that you did have this flow of 12B1 fees, and that was one of the reasons to be a broker-dealer. In a world where an enhanced standard of care arises and 12B1 fees are capped, are any of you at all worried that these are both forces that drive us away from a viable or vibrant broker-dealer model and into the advisor space?
Well, so 12B1 fees have typically been a way that, for load funds, put aside no load funds, different set of issues. For load funds, 12B1 fees have been a way that customers can pay for advice over time. You know, as opposed to paying, you know, an upfront payment, they pay over time. And I think they have worked for the sort of mid-level investors who, you know, can't afford to don't have a high enough net worth to be of interest to investment advisors, to full registered investment advisors. I think the issue is, you know, there is an inherent conflict there, and there have been situations where broker dealers have sold load funds to customers in a situation where the customer would have been better off in a different kind of account relationship. They ended up over time paying a lot more through the 12B1 fees than through an alternative kind of arrangement. So, you know, one of the issues that comes up both on the brokerage side and on the advisor side is finding an account structure that is the right account structure for a particular customer and the right way to pay for their advice. And, you know, it's a hard line to draw, but I would argue that there is a group of investors for which, you know, load funds has been the only way where they can effectively get any kind of investment advice.
The biggest rule with Rule 12b-1 fees is its name. If you just call them ongoing sales charges, it would be much clearer to people. And no matter what, whether you call it ongoing sales charges, Rule 12b-1 fees, or Ralph, the market will demand a certain amount of money to exchange a transaction. And what you need is just more clarity and more transparency.
I think that's one of the things that the new rule hopes to do with the account level charges. You know, it's funny, Hardy characterized the 12b-1 fees as paying for advice. I think a fund person might have pointed out they paid for distribution. I think we get the parallel, but it's sort of an interesting way to look at it. Anything else you want to say about the 12b-1 or how these interact? Let me go back to something in the RAND report that I mentioned earlier, and I'd be curious to get your thoughts, and I think especially you, David. And this is the question of disclosure. Keeping in mind that all this is about improving the quality of services that come to investors, if you take the RAND report at its face and disclosure is not read, and even if crafted well, and that's a statement that comes from industry professionals, and you and many other people have pointed out that disclosure is really an important part of the fiduciary duty because it is part of shaping and describing it in a very active way. How should we think about relying more or leaning on fiduciary duty in a world where the retail investor, which is the subject of this study and the subject of what we're talking about here, is fundamentally not reading the disclosure? Does that disturb you at all?
Yeah, it disturbs me. Doesn't it disturb you? I think it disturbs everybody. But I don't know of a better way to deal with this, and I think this is something that everybody has to work on. I talk to members of our organization, and you know, they want sophisticated clients. They want people to understand what they're doing. So you have to read some stuff, I think, to get to that point, to be a sophisticated investor, to make intelligent, informed choices. I don't know how you solve the problem that you've eloquently stated. I know that it's a problem. It's a problem for me. I get stuff in the mail from banks and my modest investments, and most of it I throw in the trash can. So I'm guilty as charged. People tend to trust their advisor, and whether that's a broker or a planner or an investment advisor, it's human nature, and we don't want to read that stuff. I think the SEC has to, but I don't think you throw disclosure out the window. Those of you who are familiar with the investment advisory profession, you know that the SEC is just adopted a final rule on Form ADV Part 2, a plain English disclosure, but you always have this tension between full disclosure and is it understandable or readable, much less is anybody really going to read it. So I wish I had the solution, Eric. I think it's education, and you keep trying to pound that, and it's you working as a college professor, and it's law firms, and it's regulators, it's everybody. It's something everybody can agree on. It'd be better, but I don't know how you solve the issue.
I guess a couple of thoughts on disclosure. I mean, it is generally true, again, under the restatement of agency, that, you know, with full and fair disclosure, a client can consent to a conflict of interest on behalf of the agent. That being said, there are some limits to that proposition, and you can't disclose your way out of a conflict if the client doesn't have a basic understanding of what is being disclosed. I think there's some products that are sufficiently complicated that there are some investors that even if you put the full disclosure in front of them, they're just not going to understand. And I don't think you can go forward and sell that product just because you've made disclosure. And beyond that, I mean, under state law, there's a prudent investor standard that applies to fiduciaries, and that's a substantive standard, and you can't disclose your way out of that standard. So, you know, disclosure is helpful, but I don't think that disclosure is, at the end of the day, you know, the panacea for brokerage firms, even as a legal matter, putting aside the issue which you raise, which is a very good one, which is that a lot of customers don't bother to read the disclosures they get now.
The notion that people don't read disclosure doesn't bother me a little bit. Disclosure is a liability limitation for the street. And what you really need is a right disclosure. If people choose not to read it, it is caveat emptor, even in a fiduciary setting. And the notion that people don't read disclosure will never change. I've never read a prospectus, unless I had to litigate one, in my life.
But you know, I just want to point out, this doesn't just cut against the advisor model. I think, you know, you start to read some of the comment letters that have come in, it points out that folks who are favoring the brokerage model say you need to streamline that which is in 2063. You can't go with, you know, trade-by-trade disclosure for principal trade. You need to perhaps upfront this. Well, in a world where people aren't reading disclosure, what good is upfronting disclosure, you know, putting something...
People do read disclosure. And if they, again, but when we built the non-discretionary model, there was a special box. They had it signed multiple times. And one of the boxes they had to sign was, please understand that we will be trading as principal. But then you have other backstops in place that protect the client and you if the client decided just to sign the bottom line. This disclosure issue is a pet peeve of mine, because it just, that people don't read it is just, you'll never fix that.
That would strike fear in the hearts of ex-commission employees. Well, but
I understand that, but it's inescapable.
It's a fair point. Let me. We're almost out of time. I want to touch on one thing real quick, and this is a question that's often brought up in this space. I think it harkens back to something Hardy said earlier about the broker-dealer model. It's the question of an SRO for advisors. I know it's a bugaboo. We could spend an hour on it, but it's clearly something that is in the air once again. So let me start with David real briefly. Belt and suspenders, unnecessary. You know, it's been written about for years. In light, real briefly, of where we are today, do we need it?
Absolutely unnecessary. It's an extra layer of bureaucracy and cost. Self-regulation, by definition, involves an inherent conflict of interest. Our good friends at FINRA are obviously lobbying actively to become the SRO for investment advisors. There's no secret about that. I think FINRA especially is poorly suited to regulate the investment advisor profession. Lack of transparency, lack of accountability, a bad track record, the costs involved, and perhaps the most important, a bias favoring the broker-dealer model. Would be happy to expand on any of those.
Well, so let me turn to Hardy, because you said two things. One is, I think you said FINRA might not be the best entity to do it, and then there's a question generally of, A, could FINRA be fixed up to make it the best entity, or two, could another SRO arise? They're really separable.
Yeah, so, and I guess I will go back to what I said earlier, more cops on the beat are better than fewer cops on the beat. I mean, the last several years, the SEC has examined only about 9% of SEC-registered investment advisors. A number of states, prominently including New York, don't examine state-registered investment advisors at all, because they don't have authority to do it. You know, David said, and I think we all agree, the SEC should get more resources to be able to do more examination on the investment advisor side. But right now, there's only one cop on the beat for any investment advisor, and in many states and at the federal level, that cop is not on that beat nearly often enough, and that problem needs to be solved. And if the SEC had gotten self-funding in Dodd-Frank, maybe the SEC could have solved it. It needs to be solved some way, and you know, my personal opinion is an SRO that has the ability to fund itself from the industry, as opposed to having to go to Congress for appropriations, is the only way that that's ever going to get solved.
Well, Mike, any last word before we?
I think where you stand depends on where you sit. Being at a large wirehouse for a while and being at other places, the notion of FINRA not regulating investment advisors, I don't believe it. It happens all the time. When we were building non-discretionary advisory models, we went with a dog and pony show to everybody, including FINRA, because we knew they would come in and look at it.
And it is true that they don't go to pure investment advisors, but I do think it's better to have more cops on the beat than not.
Look, I think we could continue on this topic, but in all fairness, our time is coming to an end. Hardy, Mike, David, thank you for joining me today for this discussion. We can only wait and see, as the rulemaking process is finalized early next year, if what we envision becomes reality. On behalf of the SEC Historical Society, I would again like to thank Bingham McCutcheon for its generous support and assistance in making today's program possible. It's been a privilege to partner with you. An audio of today's program is now available at www.sechistorical.org, and a transcript will be ready soon in the Virtual Museum and Archive. Thank you again to our audiences, both here at the Bingham offices in New York and online at www.sechistorical.org. Good evening.